Now, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. Hi, David. I know one of the stories is about instant sunglasses. What are the other two about?
Hey, Rob. Well, the other two stories are, one's about night owls, how night owls might have a cognitive advantage over early morning people. And the last one's about how good of a job did China do cleaning up the smoggy air in advance of the Beijing Olympics.
Okay, well, let's start with the instant sunglasses. How instant are we talking about here?
Very instant. We're talking about 30 milliseconds, which is, I think, is shorter than the blink of an eye, probably.
And what happens in those 30 milliseconds?
Well, in those 30 milliseconds, there's a compound, and I'm sure I'm going to mess up this name, but I believe it's pronounced hexaralbimidazole, but we'll call it HABI or HABI, even if you want, for short. And this is a compound that researchers have known for a while, changes color in response to UV light. It's normally colorless, but when it's exposed to UV light, like the light from the sun, it turns blue. And so when researchers have been thinking about applications for this, they've gone, well, that would be great for sunglasses. Imagine, you know, if you had glasses you wanted to wear inside that they were clear, but the moment you stepped outside, they sort of turned a dark blue or at least a darker color that would potentially filter out some of the sun's rays or at least make the sun not as intense.
Well, if they knew about this compound for so long, why are we only hearing about it now?
Well, the problem with the compound before is that it was too slow. The transformation takes 10 seconds or longer. And obviously, if you're wearing these sunglasses, you don't want to have to wait 10 seconds for the light to dim, you know, every time you go outside. So a team sort of fiddled with this compound HABI a little bit to see if they could increase the reaction time. And the short story is that they were able to add a couple more compounds and they increased this reaction time to 30 milliseconds. So now they've got this super quick transition from colorless to dark blue.
How long does it take to transition back to colorless?
It's the same to transition back. So if you walk right back inside, your sunglasses theoretically would immediately switch to being colorless again.
I imagine a potential problem, say if you're in the shadow of a tree and the light is passing through the branches and boom, suddenly there's light, suddenly there's not. You could get really disoriented pretty fast.
I guess so. I guess there's some kinks that need to be worked out. It's sort of like these automatic lights on our cars going on in tunnels or if there's shade or something like that. You don't want these glasses to be switching back and forth too rapidly. So, and, you know, they haven't actually even applied this to sunglasses yet. This is just a potential application. But there's actually also one other neat application that has to do with data storage. Right now, a lot of data storage involves switching a magnet on and off, you know, and when it's in an on state or an off state, it records different types of data. And so now we've got this compound that switches colors, you know, so instead of switching magnetic properties, it switches the color. And researchers are wondering, you know, can we apply this to data storage? So the research is cool, but, you know, it goes beyond these instant sunglasses.
So next, good news for night owls. I'm a night owl. What does this mean for me?
Well, Rob, I am not a night owl. I think I'm an early morning person. In fact, I'm pretty sure I am. And, you know, obviously there are differences between night owls and what they call larks. You know, larks get up early and they go to bed early, and night owls go to bed late and they wake up late. And researchers have been trying to figure out, is there any sort of, beyond these sort of superficial differences, are there any sort of cognitive differences between night owls and larks? And that's what this study is all about. And it turns out, Rob, that there's two factors that really control when we go to bed at night. The first is hardwired. It's this internal clock that we have called our circadian rhythm. And this clock wires us to the 24-hour cycle of the day. But the second thing that determines when we go to bed is actually very obvious. It's something called sleep pressure, which is basically the longer you've been awake, the tireder you are, and the more you want to go to sleep.
So our circadian clocks are different. It's not like I could just start getting up earlier and then I would just go to bed earlier as a result.
Right, exactly. And the bigger question is, are there any cognitive differences between us because you're a night owl and I'm a lark?
Does that depend on the time of day?
Well, that's what researchers wanted to find out. I mean, there's so many confounding factors, you know, how much sleep, you know, you and I get and when we go to bed and, you know, are we sort of staying on our circadian clock or are we deviating from our clock? So in this new study, researchers tried to control for all these factors. They took a group of about 15 morning people and 15 night people, and they said, go to bed whenever you want, sleep as long as you want, and about an hour and a half after you wake up, we're going to give you a cognitive test. And the cognitive test they used here was, you know, basically a group of numbers would come on the screen and people would have to look at the numbers and hit a button when a certain number began to change, you know. So it was measuring reaction time and a little bit of our cognitive ability. And again, you know, when they let people sleep as long as they want, they gave this test about an hour and a half after they woke up, and also 10 hours after they woke up. And the idea was that, you know, this would control for, you know, whether somebody was sort of hardwired to be a night owl or a lark. It would just take into account, you know, how long somebody had been up. And you would expect, you know, Rob, if you're, say, waking up at 8:30 in the morning and I'm waking up at 6 in the morning, but we both take a test 10 hours after we wake up, we should perform the same because we have the same sleep pressure 10 hours later and we've controlled for our internal clock. But that's not what the researchers found. They found that the night owls did slightly better on this test 10 hours after they woke up than the larks did.
Slightly better, so statistically significantly better?
Right. Their reaction time was about 6% faster. And now when the test was given in an hour and a half after both groups woke up, both groups did pretty much the same. They only saw this difference when they gave the test 10 hours after everybody woke up.
So what's that mean exactly?
Well, what it seems to indicate is that sleep pressure builds up faster in larks like me than it does in night owls like you. As the day goes on, even though we've been awake for the same amount of time, I'm perhaps feeling more tired as the day goes on than you do. And the more tired I feel, the more my brain may start to feel a little cloudy because I'm tired and it may not do as well on a cognitive test.
I suppose that has some real-world consequences.
Well, that's the thing. It's not just a fun study to tell us what the differences are between night owls and larks. You know, it turns out, you know, when a lot of companies are trying to prevent accidents, especially when they have, you know, construction workers or people operating dangerous equipment, a lot of times the risk analysis they use has to do with, you know, what time of day it is. Should people be operating at certain times of day versus other times of day?
Students in schools,
doctors, things like that. And this study suggests that, you know, they should also pay attention to what kind of people they're dealing with. You know, based on this study, if you're dealing with a lark, you may want to have this person not be working as late in the day after they've woken up as you would with a night owl.
Or at least when you're trying to compare one person with another, have them both perform the test in their own schedule.
In their own schedule, exactly.
Okay, well, finally, China's Olympic cleanup. We all saw this on the television. It appeared as if they'd done a pretty good job.
Well, that's what they would have hoped. You know, Rob, Beijing is one of the most polluted cities on Earth. You know, there's a lot of factories there. There's tons of traffic. They've got coal-fired power plants. And, you know, there was a lot of concern in advance of the Olympics that the athletes wouldn't perform as well because there's all these pollutants in the air. So China, you know, launched this big sort of PR push and they said, you know, we're instituting all these measures. I think they tried to cut in half the number of cars that were driving on each day. They closed a lot of factories in Beijing temporarily. And their goal was to cut automobile emissions by about 60-70% and to cut industrial emissions by about 30%. So these were pretty dramatic goals. And the question is, did the Chinese government succeed?
In the actual emissions curbing or in how much pollution was in the air? Because I remember there was a big wind that came through at one point and sort of cleared things out for a couple of days anyway.
Right. Well, and that was a confounding factor, which we'll talk about in a second. But yeah, it was, you know, the focus really was on the overall pollution in the city. Did China significantly reduce the overall pollution in the air in Beijing?
So where did the data come from?
So researchers looked at satellite data. And you know, there's satellite data going back a number of years. And researchers can look at particular places of the globe and measure what they call aerosols in the air. And that's basically the particulate matter that makes up the pollutants. But they didn't just look at the satellite data. You know, as you just mentioned, Rob, you know, factors like wind can really affect pollution. They can first bring extra pollution into cities because if there's neighboring cities that are polluted, or they can push pollution out of cities by blowing them away. And also things like rain can actually flush pollutants from the air. So the researchers, you know, in addition to the satellite data, were collecting data on wind speed and wind direction and rainfall and even relative humidity. And, you know, they got all these factors together. And what they found was that overall, China was only able to cut about 10-15% of the pollution in the air around Beijing in advance of the Olympics.
So despite the best laid plans, they didn't even come close to accomplishing their goal.
Right. It was only a modest success. And the researchers say the bottom line is really that the government really didn't take the weather, you know, to be simple about it. They really just didn't take the weather into account. It turns out there's a lot of pollution, not just in Beijing, but surrounding Beijing. And if you've got wind that's going to push this polluted air into Beijing, you can take as much pollution as you want out of the air of Beijing. But if it's being blown in from nearby cities, you're not going to accomplish much. And that seems to be what happened here.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking to a couple stories, one about rogue black holes that are wandering the Milky Way, and another one about birds that dance to musical beats. It's a fun study, but it's also telling scientists a lot more about bird cognition. And in the Policy blog, as you know, Rob, swine flu is all over the news this week, and we've got a crack team of reporters, people that are experts in pandemics and in virus biology, covering every aspect of this, analyzing the news reports that come out. We've got our own news reports. We've got our own analysis of what's happening. And it's got the special science touch, which means you're really going to get a very in-depth analysis of what's going on biologically with this virus and how it could affect all of us. So you can check all of that out on Science Insider, and you can find a link to that on the Science Now homepage.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.